Our next speaker will be Dr. William Karish, who with Dr. Bob Cook had the vision to design the field veterinary program for the Wildlife Conservation Society back in 1989. Dr. Karish, or Billy as I call him, really is a pioneer in the field of wildlife health. And he built the field veterinary program with three basic principles in mind. Training and capacity building in the places that we work, high quality research and wildlife health investigations, and working with governments and wildlife managers to develop sound policy guidelines to help them in their stewardship. Billy really has worked all over the world, and he's in the past few years also was honored with becoming the co-chair for the World Conservation Union's Veterinary Specialist Group, which, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is an IUCN working group that includes over 300 members around the world that stay in touch on emerging disease issues, wildlife health, and the interactions between domestic animal and human health. Today, Billy is going to talk to us about the relationships between bushmeat, bushmeat trade, human health, and Ebola. So, Billy.
Thank you very much, Steve. That was very nice. I did want to just start with this because my talk today, I'd love to talk to you about hundreds of things, but I've been told I'm not allowed to. But I just want to put this talk in perspective because I'm going to speak about gorillas and human health, but it's just one tiny example of what we're trying to do all over the world. And WCS does have that advantage of having literally thousands of field staff, not in the health field, but in the ecology side, all over the world. So when we're talking about avian influenza this morning in Asia, we probably have close to 1,000 people doing conservation work all through Asia. So the eyes and the ears are there. In Africa, we probably have 1,000 African nationals working in the field all the time. So it's an incredible opportunity for sharing information all over the world. And hopefully we'll figure out some of that today, of how to take advantage of it. But I'm going to limit my talk here to a little project in Central Africa that started a few years ago and really kind of got us into this One Health concept because it all seemed to make sense. And so, once again, a partnership of organizations with our government counterparts, other conservation organizations, and some medical laboratories working together. And we really started out because we were concerned about the health of gorillas. We're the Wildlife Conservation Society. And so part of our mandate, if we're going to divide up the world, is to look after wildlife and the health of wildlife. But gorillas have health issues too, just like humans. And in fact, there are probably over 100 diseases, infectious diseases, shared by great apes and humans. So we see that there's a link, there's a natural linkage. And this old guy here has these facial lesions here. It's a bacterial, we think it's a bacterial disease, most of them are on these, that's related to syphilis in humans. But in gorillas, it's a different species, and it's just transferred by contact, and it's called yaws. Very common human infection in Central Africa, and now we're seeing it in different gorilla populations. We haven't unraveled which direction it went, from people to gorillas or the other way around, but I bet there's a linkage there. So we know, especially from the zoo world, we know that great apes can get very sick from things that are common among people. So we're worried when we start talking about tourism and even research projects and bringing people closer together with great apes in conservation efforts that we might give them diseases. And then local people overlap with them too because people live in the forest and they go to the bathroom in the forest and they come in contact and leave their waste behind, which can also infect animals. So we're concerned about some of these things that can affect animals. And just like people that have very poor health care, most wildlife don't get very good health care. So they die frequently from simple diseases that don't have the same effect in people in a developing country. So the common cold or the flu will kill a gorilla because they don't have doctor support. They don't have a family that says drink lots of fluids and eat well. So they get dehydrated and die. Very similar, you know, I think when we're starting to see West Nile virus get into Guatemala, we've gotten some samples from wild birds a week ago, and we think about West Nile virus in Guatemala and Nicaragua and El Salvador, where people don't have the quality of health care here, it's going to be the same disease but a very different effect on people. And likewise with wildlife and the places we work around the world. We work on the fringes of society, like Dr. Sanderson was saying this morning. In some of the areas, the people and the animals, of course, have some of the worst health care available on the planet. And that's really, I think, what ends up really bringing us together. And these are the people, and there's the fringe of society. So if you talk about where the big money goes in public health, and where the big public health foundations, say the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, where they put their money, it's usually in urban areas because that's where the people are. So you get, it's a very cost-effective approach. But there's still billions of people that live in rural areas around the world. It's very difficult to get to them. But those are the people we encounter in these wildlife areas. Those are our partners for conservation, so to speak. And then, as I mentioned, the tourism, we're really bringing everybody together now. So we get to share our diseases also if we care to. So our approach there with the gorillas is say, well, we're going to worry about the health of the gorillas. Well, we better start monitoring the health of the gorillas, so we start learning. So we start training programs. Steve just mentioned earlier about capacity building. So we go to the national parks, we get our government counterparts, we start to teach them, how do you monitor the health of the population? How do you collect samples properly? Here are some desktop kits so we can look for viruses, bacteria, parasites. Let's find out what's normal in a gorilla and start routinely doing surveillance. And it was really for the gorillas. We do training courses, we prepare materials, and this is all about wildlife health, teaching people how to do monitoring and health care. How to do a visual observation. What's a skinny animal? What's a fat animal? What's a normal animal? And collecting that data, we work across three countries with all these different groups and have everybody collecting data the same way, so it's comparable. So the work we're doing in Central African Republic and Gabon, we can actually compare the notes and say, we're seeing something different in this country. It's not a function of collecting the data differently. Now, of course, we do some hands-on field work. We've actually mobilized some gorillas to try and get baseline samples. We start to look at what infectious diseases they've been exposed to, a whole range. We're certainly concerned about Ebola. Have they been exposed to it before? And what things have they? And we turn up, you know, they're exposed naturally in the wild, or maybe from humans at one point in time in history, some infectious diseases. So they say, okay, well, the gorillas look pretty good, and they've been exposed to these. So actually, these are the things we don't have to worry about. We actually have to turn our thinking upside down. So rather than write a paper about what they've been exposed to that doesn't bother them, we think about the negative data, which you can really never write about because nobody's interested in negative data. But this is what's really important for the gorillas. They have no immunity to these diseases. So we have to think, how do we protect them from these things? They haven't been exposed to polio and look great. They haven't been exposed. They haven't been exposed to measles. We know it kills gorillas in other parts of the world. Ebola, they haven't been exposed. The healthy ones look good and haven't been exposed before. So we know they are susceptible to these diseases. So that starts us thinking about, well, what are we going to do about that? We can't vaccinate all the gorillas. Well, maybe we can reduce the risk of exposure. So that moves us upstream to the people, since they're the potential source. That gets us thinking about the health of humans as a way to protect the gorillas, and the side benefit is it's great for people. So that's where we start coming together with these concepts of One Health. Now, because of all that training we put in for years, and what Pierre had just mentioned before, we started teaching people, you know, how to collect samples, also how to do a necropsy. We're working in dangerous areas, so they have to be able to be prepared to suit up in a hazmat suit and deal with carcasses that might have Ebola, because we can't ask our staff to die. And we have, unfortunately, lost some staff in plane crashes. Dr. Kilborn, who really worked with this program early, died in a plane crash, unfortunately. We haven't lost anyone to Ebola during this work, but there's a risk. And it is something we're asking our staff to do, is put their life on the line to promote health. And it's not that different in the human response to Ebola outbreaks in humans, too. People are putting their lives on the line. But because we've done this training, we started to collect samples over the years from wildlife that were dying. So when Dr. Fulmonti mentioned that early alert system, it's because WCS has been in there for years training park guards and park managers how to properly collect samples. We still wouldn't know today any of the things he talked about had these people not been trained by WCS years ago. So we're gathering that data, training them, how to safely collect samples, how to get them into the laboratory. And then this work that just finally came out in Science was showing these outbreaks, and those were samples collected by people trained by WCS in the field. And it can have a major impact on understanding of even human diseases by monitoring the health of wildlife. And it's very cost effective. When we talked about $30 million being spent every year this morning for CWD monitoring, I mean, we were operating at 1% of that kind of budget in the field monitoring these diseases. So it's a very cost-effective approach. And the other aspect of that, I said about pulling the data together, is developing some kind of software and hardware technologies so everybody can collect this data and link it with GIS mapping and have some real-time imaging. And we're working with the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project over in Rwanda, a group in Mississippi, developing some new software that's going to give real-time linkages for mapping disease spread and also the epidemiological analysis. So you start to see percentages. So even the field staff out there will start to see when they're getting spikes in diseases. Because it's very hard to, you know, on a daily basis, you find one carcass, somebody 10 kilometers away finds another carcass, you think it's normal. But when we link that data, we'll be able to have a much finer view of what's really going on. Now, what about the other aspect of it? And that's about what I mentioned before about helping people. So, zoonotic diseases, which was also mentioned this morning, and I, you know, it's so funny because I never really think about zoonotic diseases so much, but we are talking about diseases that go from animals to people, and I'm mostly concerned about the other direction, and then we kind of forget about livestock and wildlife, but there's another edge of that triangle. So I don't really tend to use the word zoonotic. I just say these diseases shared by all, which is about 600 or 700 infectious diseases that we know of on this planet, are shared between animals and people, and they, what direction they go is anyone's guess. But we wanted to use this information for conservation. It's about building new constituencies. How do we get more people involved with what we care about, which is conservation of environment, landscapes, wildlife, and plants? And it links into this thing with the bushmeat trade. So when Dr. Formanti was mentioning the outbreaks of Ebola, it was coming, the last several have come from either eating chimpanzees or gorillas or baboons in Sudan. So there's these primates that people get their hands on, and they get infected with Ebola, and they die, and then their family members die, and it spreads through the community. And it's completely avoidable if we can educate people about the risk. So it's just a human behavior that needs to be altered. And the bushmeat trade, as many of you know, is just huge. So if you look in the Congo or in Gabon or in CAR, in the middle of the forest, which was just a pristine area except for some local people living there for years and probably dying of Ebola without us ever knowing about it, you have logging operations and other development activities bringing thousands of people in to these remote areas. And they need food because they don't have livestock. Livestock don't do very well in the forest. And if they brought in livestock, they'd probably introduce a disease like rinderpest and wipe out everything anyway. So we don't really want to just encourage the movement of domestic animals around the world and into remote areas. So we have to kind of come up with some other creative ways. But the bushmeat trade is huge. We're talking about billions of pounds of meat per year. So if you look at statistically, let's say what the odds were with BSE coming from domestic cattle to humans, and maybe it's 1 in a billion, well, if the odds are the same for another disease from bushmeat, 1 in a billion, we've got 2 good chances every year that it's going to happen. So it's really a statistics game when you start getting to large volumes, lots of encounters, a lot of encounter rates. Even a low probability disease transmission becomes pretty much a sure thing. And it's not just all bushmeat. So Kate Abernathy, David Wilkie, some great people working for WCS have started to actually look at what's going on. And it's not just the same across the board. So, you know, the big question is, well, who eats wildlife? There's some of it, there is a gourmet market in the cities, and we've read, there's actually Gourmet Magazine did a piece on it about the gourmet foods of bushmeat. But that's not the big bulk of it. Where people have money and access to other food, they tend to eat other things. So in Libreville, the capital, as people are wealthier, they have access to other resources. It's not an urban thing. They're not eating a lot of bush meat. But out in the villages, where people are very poor, they don't have access to other things, they're very dependent on bush meat. So we start to think, well, we can't tell them not to eat bush meat. That'll be terrible. Because they'll starve. Well, all bush meat is not created equally. So you have different things going on. If you look at what they're really eating, the biggest percentage are small rodents, porcupines, small antelope with very high reproductive rates. You know, in a lot of ways, this is not a big conservation issue. Those animals reproduce quickly. If there's a small village and they're doing it sustainably, they can do very well, and that's become an important protein source. What's not really happening is they're not eating very many great apes. It's pretty rare. I think the figure is 3% of the diet really comes from gorillas, chimps, mandrills, some of the charismatic primates. It's a very low proportion of what their protein intake is. So to ask them to stop that in exchange for understanding that they may not have Ebola outbreaks is not a difficult sell if it's done properly. And then in a lot of villages, those animals have been hunted out anyway, so it's not even an issue. But where they still are there, it's not too hard to convince them. So we've been actually just getting out in the field, like Dr. Formanti said. In fact, we kind of borrow information from WHO and Red Cross and other people and start doing village outreach and education, because these are the people living around parks and protected areas. They're the same people that aren't getting any health care, and it's the same people that WCS is interfacing with all the time. These are our local partners, and these villagers are the stewards of the protected areas around. So we're interacting with them anyway, so it's a great opportunity to provide education on how they can stay healthier, and it also protects some of the more endangered species. And you say, well, why are we excited about it? And I'm personally excited because I think in a lot of places around the world, because we care about wildlife, we think other people will care about wildlife too and share our ethos and our cultural values. So you go to a villager and say, you shouldn't eat the gorillas because gorillas are really great. And they just look at you and they smile and they think, that's really funny. And then you talk about Ebola outbreaks and they know somebody or they've seen it or they've experienced it in their lifetime, you say, that's how you're getting it. One of the hunters brought it in. And you talk to the women, talk to the kids, and they don't want a disease outbreak in their family. They don't have health care. They can't deal with these things. So you can give them a linkage, you give them a reason, then they're like, okay, we're not going to take that risk. It's not because they love gorillas. They love their family and don't want to get sick. So it's about building this different kind of constituency for conservation, about bringing people together and getting the hook so we can all work together. We're going to try also, that was that top-down education approach where we tell people what they should think and do, and we're the experts. Scientists love that. We tell everybody what they should think and do. But there's another educational method which is more kind of bottom-up, and we're trying to play with this idea this coming year with theater and conservation. And training local theater troops, so have pygmies and Bantus in Central Africa, have them trained as actors and dancers and songsters and some of the children, and let them go from village to village, and you do peer-to-peer education, so it's more of a bottom-up, rather than outside experts telling people what to do. You create local experts that share that knowledge, and where we've seen this work very well in Southern Africa with conservation issues, so we want to adapt it now for health issues too. We think it's going to be, has a lot of potential. So that final goal, once again, is healthy wildlife is our responsibility, but we're finding that healthy people can do a lot to have healthy wildlife. Their lives are better, so it's one of these win-win situations. Everybody comes out ahead. If we can have healthier people, their lives are better, can be more productive, they use fewer resources, and we can also, and all of that fits in with protecting the environment, having a healthier planet. So, thank you.